On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
I was born in Florida and moved out of Florida to come to Alabama for college back in the early 1970s. Since the time I left Florida, it's exploded in number of people there. But as it turns out, a lot of people have been moving into Florida all the time I've been growing up there. They came from up north and they were given promises of a little paradise, a piece of the good life at $10 down and $10 a month until they paid off their lot. The true story of what happened to those folks and the people who sold them those lots is included in The Swamp Peddlers, how lot sellers, land scammers, and retirees built modern Florida and transformed the American dream. It's from Jason Vuick and is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Jason Vuick is the author as well of The Yucks, 2 years in Tampa with the losingest team in NFL history, and this one I've got to get a copy of, The Yugo, The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History. Jason, thanks so much for joining me today on The Bookshelf.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
What got you interested in the amazing adventure that was the growth of Florida starting in the 1950s?
Well, I grew up in Punta Gorda, which is, you know, an old Florida town. For South Florida, one of the oldest. It was
right. It
was platted, I believe, in the 1880s. And, you know, I grew up in a 100-year-old house, an old wooden Victorian with a double lot leading down a brick street to a 100-year-old park. It was named for a governor, Gilchrist. He was the mayor of Punta Gorda and became the governor of Florida. And so all around me were these large mid-century modern developments, Port Charlotte, Northport, Cape Coral, Lehigh Acres, Golden Gate Estates, that contrasted sharply with Punta Gorda. You know, mm-hmm. Punta Gorda could be any small town in Alabama,
right?
Any small town in the East. It was a whistle-stop town. It was the last stop in 1900 on the railroad. You could go from, you know, Portland, Maine to Punta Gorda, and that's where it ended.
Right.
And so I always wanted to know, you know, why are these, you know, it was one community, Charlotte County, it was Port Charlotte and Punta Gorda, but why were these towns so radically different? And when I say different, I mean extremely. We have, you know, a core town, we have old buildings, we have old streets, we have the old neighborhood, and then it, you know, breaks out into the suburb, like most towns. Mm-hmm. Well, Port Charlotte had 200,000 80 by 125 foot lots. 200,000 lots with no downtown, no sidewalks, and no industry.
Right.
And I always wanted to know, you know, why that was. Who lived here? How did people first come down to Port Charlotte and why? I mean, clearly this had been carved out of either virgin land or ranch land, you know, something like that when I first thought about it. But mm-hmm. more than anything else, I remember in high school, roads to nowhere, just endless roads, because when they sold these lots by law, if they sold them in installments, which I'll explain, they had to have a road, state law.
Right.
So we had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles of empty roads. And so the back end of Port Charlotte or the back end of Cape Coral, I remember, it's one of the biggest cities in Florida now. It's probably 250,000 people down there now.
Right.
But the back end of it was, it looked like Mad Max. It looked like some sort of post-apocalyptic, you know, like someone had dropped a, you know, what is it, the nitrogen, what's the bomb? The bomb that kills all the people and,
right,
and leaves the buildings.
Yeah, the neutron bomb.
Right? It was like someone had dropped that and left the street signs and the cul-de-sacs, but there'd be no houses or one house, and then you'd have like, you know, a mile to the next house.
Right. And in between,
and I just all these wanted to know.
All these little roads, right? Just little roads.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Roads to nowhere. And,
yeah.
And you know, we didn't really have, we had ranches around us, but when we were in high school, we would go make out or have a bonfire or race cars or whatever young kids did. We went to these roads to nowhere. and so as a writer, you know, you put ideas in the back of your head. You know, I have kind of a file in my head of quirky and interesting ideas. And one was just kind of explaining the development of Florida, you know, through the prism of these 1950s and 60s era land developments. And what I found out was that After World War II, there was a demand for retirees to come to Florida. Three brothers, the Mackle brothers, who had built Key Biscayne, they were builders from Miami, knew how to, kind of like the Levitt brothers, or like William Joseph Levitt in Levittown of New York. Mm-hmm. They knew that if they could provide lots and, assembly line-like homes that were built as cheaply as possible to returning GIs. But the Mackles realized it's not the returning GIs like Levitt in New York or Pennsylvania. We need to cater to retirees, lower-income retirees, people on fixed pensions, policemen and teachers and cops and firemen and Ford workers and retiring Army, soldiers, yeah. That had been in for a career. If we can come up with a way to sell them lots and to sell them homes cheaply, we're going to make a lot of money. And they hit on buying up desirable land, but not waterfront per se. Port Charlotte has some waterfront lots, but they hit on the idea of buying up a large 78,000 acre ranch, kind of a denuded forest, a little bit off of the water, but still in South Florida, right. Still close to the beach, but not on it, not Naples, not Sarasota, but inland a tiny bit. They could buy up this land in the 50s for about $4 million, about $40 an acre. They could divide these lots up and sell homes to Northerners. And at first, they began advertising, and people started to write in and say, we'd like to buy land here. We'd like to buy a home, but we're not ready. My husband's a mailman. He's going to retire in 5 years. I'm a teacher. Is there a way we could put land on layaway? Is there a way we could put a little bit of money down? And so the Mackles, on a whim in the 50s, came up with the idea of $10 down and $10 a month. And soon they received, and one writer, that a local real estate agent wrote this, that in Port Charlotte, they began receiving bushels full of cash that people would send them a coupon, sign your name and $10, send a $10 bill or a check. And they had to bring bushels full of cash to the bank. And they began selling, 10,000 lots, 20,000 lots, 30,000 lots. Not really homes, lots.
Right.
And so that the sale of lots kind of opened up a Pandora's box. And soon enough, other people began to imitate the Mackles. The Mackles formed the General Development Corporation. In Cape Coral, the Rosen brothers formed the Gulf American Corporation, which soon was one of the largest corporations in the state. It had at one time 5,000 employees. So you're talking Florida Power and Light level, the size, massive. And they began selling, some of the first 1-800 numbers and call centers, win a week in Florida contests. They would have sales dinners like in Poughkeepsie, New York, come tonight to see a video at the Holiday Inn and we'll have a free steak dinner and a drink. Right.
Yeah.
And they began selling Florida.
Mm-hmm. Now mm-hmm. That's the same kind of thing that happens now for condos and timeshares. People walk up
sure.
to you on the beach and say, hey, would you like to have a free steak dinner on us? It's just a little meeting. And you say, are you guys a religious cult or something? And say, oh no, just come and you'll see. It's a free steak. What can you lose? And that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
And so these guys, these modern guys didn't invent it. These guys in the 1950s invented this approach and according to your book, they had these vast networks of people that would call. Make cold calls over the telephones to people up north and say, hey, wouldn't you like to live in the land of flowers, I grew up in Daytona Beach, and I remember when Deltona got started and when Palm Coast got started, and Palm Coast, which is nowhere near the coast, and Deltona, which is between DeLand and Daytona and is not near the beach, but and just like Port Charlotte, which is far enough back from the water that you'd be hard-pressed to call an actual port. But it sounds like you're going to have water in your background, doesn't it? And like you're going to have a room for a slip for a boat or something,
Yeah. Well, the key in this is the Mackle brothers. I wrote, and by all accounts, were pretty straight shooters. They were using economies of scale, so they didn't need to rip off a person for $10 or $800. They were trying to sell hundreds of thousands of lots, and so I don't believe anyone who purchased a lot for $895 in Port Charlotte in 1958 was ripped off.
Right.
But what happens is, one of the Mackles has this great quote kind of in the early 90s as he was older. He looked back and he told a writer, we came up with this $10 down and $10 a month deal. I'm paraphrasing, but we let in a lot of bad people who abused the business.
Mm.
And so soon enough, that model of cold calling you on the phone, what you mentioned, those people selling you timeshares, they call that bird dog.
Yeah.
And so you'd be, at the Don Cesar for, think of Florida in the 50s and early 60s, pre-Disney, pre-Miami Dolphins, pre-Buccaneers, right. This is the Florida of High Li, the Florida of dog tracks and beaches and Fort Lauderdale, the Rat Pack coming down and Miami Beach. And so you're there on your honeymoon and or you're just there for vacation and a pretty girl in a bikini comes up to you and says, "Hi, how you doing? You interested in Florida lots?" And they called this bird dogging. They'd go to Busch Gardens or they'd go to, Sunken Gardens or these original Weeky Watchy, and they'd meet you in the parking lot. They'd go to Cape Canaveral. You're trying to see a launch and they'd go, "Hey, you want a free trip to River Ranch?" And so the Mackles used high-pressure tactics, but they weren't really the scammers. They were community builders. I mean, they built Key Biscayne in its entirety.
Right.
But the lot sales became so big that even the Mackles realized this is where the money is. This is, and so by the 70s, I'd say by the mid-70s, I don't even know how many lots came out of this, but probably 2 million vacant lots. 2 million.
Good
night. I mean, Southwest Florida alone, Port Charlotte had 200,000, Cape Coral 140,000, Lehigh Acres 120. You're looking at half a million lots in two or three counties. So imagine the rest of the state when everyone is jumping on board, to peddle swamp. Essentially, is what I call it.
Yeah.
And so that's really what the book is about.
Now the Mackles did develop kind of a system. Like you said, these guys were pretty straight shooters, that they had limitations on the size of the community, that they implemented coordinated growth with the idea of developing businesses and all that. Because as you point out in the book, that if you don't have businesses, then the property taxes eat the residents alive, because businesses pay generally more money for the property they use and don't use things like schools and such as that you need for residents.
Sure, sure.
And they also had, I'm looking at your book, to provide central water and sewage systems to Deltona's core home sites. This, I never even thought about this until I read your book, and then I just kind of got this cold feeling in the pit of my stomach, and I thought, okay, so you have all of these houses with septic tanks and wells in the same general vicinity. And the water table, yep, in Florida, because you and I both know, because we grew up in Florida, the water table is not very, it is very high. If you want to get water, my dad and I dug a hole in our backyard in Daytona Beach, a block down from the ocean, and we went down 8 feet and we got water. Now, it was water that smelled like rotten eggs, but you could use that to sprinkle, uh-huh, your lawn. You wouldn't want to drink it unless you had to. But
sure,
you 8 feet. So imagine you're dropping a septic tank, and which we had. They were in a non-incorporated area at that point, not in Daytona Beach Shores. So there's a septic tank on one side of the lawn, a well on the other side of the lawn. What is good about this system?
When I looked into this book, my first idea was, knowing Port Charlotte, which was the original of these $10 down, $10 a month deals.
I mean,
there were other communities that did it, But no one did it like the Mackles. Nobody put in the millions of dollars to popularize this on a mass scale. So I say they're the first, and I say Port Charlotte's the first, though there were some earlier ones all over the state, especially in Daytona, that area. But the Mackles did this, and so I wanted to write about kind of, you know, land scamming of Northerners and some kind of, you know, darkly comedic history. I thought that would be sort of funny.
Right.
And as I got into it, I realized I had written a book, or I was starting to write a book, about failed development practices.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize, I didn't start out, I didn't even think about this kind of stuff. And as I got into the book, more and more, I began tracking down not just land developers, but urban planners. You know, men and women who work for counties, work for cities, who deal with these issues. And I found that, you know, when you chop up lots, essentially you're looking at four lots per acre, three lots per acre. So you've got four homes, you know, you've got septic tanks at the front, and you've got water wells in the back.
Yeah.
and when it floods, in some places, unfortunately, they would recycle waste, and it would get into the water table. And so you know, and there was no one there in Florida that was saying this is a bad idea. Florida was so pro-development. And until the 1970s, this is amazing for anyone who really pays attention to what I'm saying here. Before the 1970s, only municipalities in Florida had the right to plan and zone. So some counties like Dade or Hillsborough, the big ones, would get an act of the state legislature say you can plan and zone in Hillsborough County in unincorporated areas. But places like Charlotte, where I grew up, and some of these other counties, St. Lucie, up until the 70s, you could build whatever you wanted.
Right.
Without anyone telling you no, anything. So if you wanted to build, for example, Port Charlotte, by 1960, they built several thousand homes, churches, a school, a shopping center, all these buildings without ever having a building inspection.
Right. Right. See, I can
let
remember,
alone anyone going.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad was an architect, but his hobby was woodworking because his father had been a carpenter in Tallahassee. So in our little typical Florida house, he decided to change it into a Japanese style house. And he added onto the back of the house and built all these things in the garage and put them up a tea house that wasn't in the back, all this stuff. And he didn't ever have a building permit. We were in an unincorporated area. There was no such thing as a building permit. There was no, actually, he didn't even need to have an architect, another architect or an engineer sign off on it, because he could show them the plans that he did them himself, and they didn't even require that.
You know, it's one thing, I get that many people want the freedom to, you know, to not be under regulations and blah, 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 fine. But when you build tens of thousands of homes, or when you plat a community with 200,000 lots and no one has told you, this is going to be bad in 2020. You know, this is going to be untenable in, you know, this is going to be a problem for schools, for, you know, oftentimes because they were trying to sell as many lots as possible, they would plat, you know, 200,000 lots.
Yeah.
And then only leave small sections for industry or schools or parks. And so these communities all over the state. And so, you know, what came out of this? What are we talking about? Port Charlotte, Cape Coral, Northport, Lehigh Acres, Golden Gate Estates. Those are some of the fastest growing communities in Florida.
Right.
Cape Coral is bigger than Tallahassee and Fort Lauderdale. Port St. Lucie. Port St. Lucie is bigger than Cape Coral. It's one of the biggest cities in the state.
Right.
Palm Bay used to be Port Malabar. It was one of the port communities. That's big. Palm Coast, Deltona, Spring Hill, north of Tampa. I mean, these are some of the biggest communities that, you know, in the future will be some of the biggest communities in Florida, because that's still where the land is. There's still lots to be had. Well, in the beginning, going back to Port Charlotte, you know, they didn't sell that many homes, but they sold many, many lots. And so when I was a kid, Port Charlotte didn't need more than US 41, some strip malls. That was plenty.
Right.
You know, we only had, there's probably 15, 20,000 people there in the 80s. That was plenty. But now as it's filling out, as Cape Coral is filling out, as Lehigh Acres, especially Lehigh Acres out there, there's not, people are saying you better buy that land because you're going to need 8 high schools in the next 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, you better buy it now, or Best Buy, or some land developer is going to buy that last big plot of land, or we're in deep trouble. And so you have these problems of water, of traffic, of and then, as you mentioned, with industry, Cape Coral, for example, you know, when you've platted 100,000, 120,000 lots, there's no room for a factory. There's no room for a corporate campus. You know, I asked these urban planners at a big conference. I said, you know, if Jeff Bezos, if I say the name right, pointed at Cape Coral and said, I want to put my world headquarters for Amazon right there, Cape Coral would go, great, but we don't have any land for you.
Right.
You know, we have 50,000 empty lots, but we can't put them together into one big parcel. You know, there's no way to undo the plats. And so, you know, these are platted lands. These are promised lands that can never be changed in these communities. So Cape Coral, Port Charlotte, Port St. Lee, these are all going to be big, giant residential bedroom communities forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no way around it. You know, and so that's what I learned in writing a book I thought would be about selling lots, but actually turned into the kind of the sins of the grandfathers.
Now,
is what I wrote about.
Here's something else that I learned from your book, to my dismay. I'd heard rumors about this, and I'd read other reports about, if you promise everybody in this particular little town that they all can have a boat slip behind their house, so you're going to cut a canal for them. Now, if the water wasn't there already, but there's water everywhere, so that means you're going to have to dredge up a lot of wet land and make it wetter. And if it was kind of inland, that means the water is probably fresh water. If you dredge it so that they can have access to the Gulf or the Atlantic Ocean, now you've got an interplay between freshwater, flora and fauna, and salt. And not everything can live in brackish water. The things that can live in brackish water, like alligators, they're not as welcome. What you're doing is screwing up the environment of an entire half of a state so that you can chop it into pieces and sell it as little lots, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one example is Cape Coral. That's the most drastic one.
Right.
That's right across from Fort Myers in southwest Florida. It's a nice community. You know, I have nothing against these communities. It's just a lot of these weren't rationally planned. And so when the Rosen brothers, they were rivals of the Mackles. They were, you know, tough former carnival barkers from Baltimore who decided, you know, they weren't going to sell. They were selling shampoo at one time for $1 a bottle on radio and TV. And they decided, why are we selling shampoo for $1 a bottle? We can sell land in Florida for $1,000 a lot.
Right.
And they came down and they bought a big stretch on the Caloosahatchee, kind of this low-lying swampy, seasonally swampy. You know, so in the winter it's dry, you can hunt there, people would fish there, and in the summer it'd be really wet and sloggy. Well, they bought this area called Redfish Point, and in order to raise the land 5.5 feet above sea level for septic tanks, they began dredging it, and that had the added bonus of creating waterfront lots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you dredge canals, you use the dirt to raise the land up, and you put in seawalls, bulkheads and seawalls. Well, that sounds great. And you see the early pictures, and there are these, you know, they call them finger islands, you know, these little peninsulas that jut out that have, you know, you have your car in the front and your driveway, and in the back you have a boat.
Right.
Sounds like Florida living. It sounds wonderful. And so Cape Coral is just it's a community of these. There's 400 miles of man-made canals in Cape Coral. 400 miles. It's more than any city in the world. They say, and I wrote in the book, but I had no way of really checking it, but all the big canal cities that I'd ever heard of were smaller than that. Venice, Italy, one-fourth of that.
Yeah.
And they began selling this property, and it's wonderful. I visit friends and I sit in the back dock in these places and go, wow, I get it. I get what people want.
Sure.
But when you dredge all of that land, you bring in, you know, billions of gallons of river water, seawater that had, you know, never been that far up into the land. And so you invite all these problems. In the very beginning of Cape Coral, they were getting the water wells had metal casings. Well, the seawater would eat at the metal casings and get down into the wells and get into the aquifer. And so they were beginning to have big problems there of poisoned aquifers, and they've largely fixed that, but there's no returning 400 miles or, you know, however many miles of seawater, of saltwater canals, like half, it's like half and half or something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's say 200 miles, 200 miles. It's like adding a river, a salt river, up into land that had never had such a thing in it. And, you know, I'm not an environmentalist, but these ideas, these canals were just, were devastating for the environment, these bulkheads and these seawalls. And they're also going to be very problematic in the future with global warming, with sea level rise. You know, they're fast and firm barriers to water. Well, that water has to go somewhere.
Right.
You know, it's either going to be pushed further inland or go up and over. Those are hard barriers. You know, they don't absorb water like the mangroves used to. The mud and the mangroves kind of served a purpose naturally.
Yeah.
Now they don't do that, you know, and so who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? But that's what you're talking about. And now I know they have saltwater intrusion all the way up the Caloosahatchee, all the way up into Lake Okeechobee. You know, they have issues with saltwater intrusion up there. Now, is this from all these canals? I don't know. Certainly, they're digging deeper channels, and what happens, you know, with all that boat traffic, what happens in summer when it rains a lot, all that rainwater comes out of the center of the state, and so the brackish water is fresher in these, you know, in Charlotte Harbor on the Peace River, in Caloosahatchee. But then in the winter, that salt water doesn't have anything pushing on it. There's not any rain, so that salt water comes in, and salt water is heavier, and salt water sinks, and it just sits there, and it never leaves. So the more we've developed and cut channels, and the more we've built canals, and the more we've built on the water, the more we've brought salt water in inadvertently. Yeah. So that's part of the story.
It is really a fascinating story, albeit a little horrifying too, but the truth sometimes is a little horrifying. The funny thing is, I can remember these little bitty houses, like the ones that the Mackles originally built, that we called them vacation houses. Basically, it was a cottage. One bedroom, one bath, little kitchen, little living room area, and a carport. And that was about it. And I saw them all over Florida growing up. And I thought, oh, aren't they cute? Never thought about the fact that they were built to sell to retirees from up north so they could have a piece of the good life in Florida. Absolutely fascinating book, Jason.
It's complicated. You know, it's modern Florida, right? Yeah. It, there's no easy answers. And, you know, it wasn't easy for me to write it. You know, I find, you know, one thing I even left out of the book that I regret already one year later was the whole sea level rise and global warming. You know, many of these communities will be threatened in the future.
So I'm not worried about that so much as I am just the brackish water and all of that. That's a big enough problem to be concerned about. But I think awareness is a critical component of this, and I think you're going to really open the eyes of a lot of people that either bought stuff in Florida, and now they're wondering, oh my gosh, was this a good idea? Or they've been living on it for a while and starting to realize, there's issues here. And this kind of opens their eyes up. It certainly did mine. And so I want to say thanks for writing the book and for making it available.
Yeah, thank you. And
do you have a website, Jason?
Yes, it's jasonvuick.com, and you can also find the book, The Swamp Peddlers. Probably the easiest is Amazon. You know, there's a cheap Kindle edition if anyone's interested. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Our thanks to Jason Vuick, who is the author of The Swamp Peddlers, How Lot Sellers, Land Scammers, and Retirees Built Modern Florida and Transformed the American Dream. It's from the University of North Carolina Press. It's available in hardback, paperback, and in Kindle. You can check out his website, Jason Vuick, that's JasonVuick.com. Thanks so much for joining us on The Bookshelf. You should also check out my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com, where I have over 450 interviews archived, ones that have done recently, but ones that go back to 2011, and I'm kind of working my way backwards to get some of the really special ones from before that. Join us next time on the radio and listen to my podcast. And until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.